Hey, this is Harpo the Healer. Welcome to Harping with Harpo series. This is pod 40. These pods are a supplement to Harpo the Healer on YouTube. Don't forget to go back and check out all other episodes. You'll note some are loosely based on blues and blues harmonica. However, we're not rooted and explore many interesting avenues covering some famous unsolved mysteries and in-depth analysis, while if not on a musical area of interest, cover some great feats of human endeavour and dig into the human condition. Today, I'm a solo talking head and I'm looking at reincarnation. Is there any credible proof outside of belief? What can we look at to try and substantiate it or reject it? And perhaps briefly look at other religions to see if anything's built in their way of thinking or not. I'll dig out two or three fascinating stories, and wherever possible, I'll try to be as impartial as I can. Like all these things, it often boils down to belief rather than fact or truth, but I'll dig into it and see what comes up. If you feel the podcast is beneficial in any way, Harpo the Healer YouTube's got a link on there to donate to channel and help drive us forward. Reincarnation, a transformation of the soul, rebirth, a person or animal in some of their religions, and some, not all, in whom a particular soul is believed to have been reborn, or a new version of the past. Reincarnation is also known as transmigration. Is the philosophical or religious concept that the non-physical essence of a living being begins in a new life in a different physical form or body after biological death. Although this type of belief is the idea is the soul of a human being is immortal and does not die or fade away after the body has died. After death, the soul simply becomes transferable to an animal or newborn child to continue its journey. Not all of these so-called beliefs believe that you might go into sort of animal form. A lot believe that you're kind of moving forward into a better time, providing you've lived a good life, and however you've worked hard in this life enhances you for the next one. So there are many differences between them, but the common theme, of course, with these particular religions is reincarnation. The word transmigration is the passing of the soul from one body to another after death, and the word reincarnation is not, as some older listeners might think, a form of condensed milk. A touch of humour there. Reincarnation is derived from the Latin, which simply means entering the flesh again. And basically, that you continue to live after death. All living things in some cultures. Now, before I delve into reincarnation in any depth, I thought it'd be a good idea to briefly summarise which religions have a belief in reincarnation and which ones don't. So, just bear with it for a few secs while I go through this, and then I'll get into a couple of fascinating stories, which it's all about story really, isn't it? That's what we're really into, so I want to get to that, but I've just got to go through this first. So first off, now obviously I'm not covering all religions because there's many different religions. I'm just picking a few here. But some of the religions that do have a form belief of this idea of reincarnation, albeit from different complicated standpoints, are Jainism, Buddhism and Hinduism. And from what I can ascertain, the beginnings are hugely difficult to pin down. However, let's say around that India gave rise to the idea BCE, that's before the Common Era. So around the middle of the first millennium, first texts say around 1100, 500 BCE, which I believe is before the Buddha and the Mahavira. However, the origins and development of thinking, there's much conjecture, and as a consequence, it's beyond the scope of this podcast. Although, things can be interpreted in many different ways, and there are odd references here and there. It would be fair to say that the two religions that completely refute the idea are Christianity and Islam. And yet, I've come across in my own personal life many, many musicians who a lot of jazz musicians believe in reincarnation, and I'll probably touch on that later on. And a lot of them have sort of like odd Christian beliefs. So there's a lot of weird mixtures in there as well. But I'm just trying to pin down the sort of slightly more fundamental believers, if you like. Now, generally speaking, the basics, the very, very basics. Buddhism concept differs from the others reincarnation believers in that in Buddhism, there's no internal spirit or self. It's simply a stream of consciousness linking life with life. As I understand it, the Buddha says there's no concept of rebirth or irreducible or self. In other words, tying these lives together, which serves as a contrast to Hinduism, where everything is brought together and joined. Now, from what I've read, Hinduism seems to be the oldest and the third largest religion in the world. The major religions after Christianity and Islam, of course. Now, there are many other religions, of course, like Sikhism, that has a soul passed from one body to another until liberation. But I don't want to get into the real trickiness. And, of course, Judaism, is that the right pronunciation? I don't believe it's mentioned in the Hebrew Bible, from what I've read. Although there are mystical texts, a kind of soul cycle references in there, but as far as I'm aware, it isn't. But as you can understand, I'm not an expert in any of these. I don't want to give a disservice to any of them in any way. I'm just trying to get an overview of which ones are really into it and not. At this point, you may be thinking, as I am at this moment, oh, I wish I'd never started. You know, it's a tough one. No, I will endeavour to fight through it. I'll get there. So, we move forward. Have faith, good listener. We'll get to the stories in a minute, for sure. But, you know, I'll just mention to everyone, all the listeners, that, you know, I'm not trying to say that one thing's better than another. Everything's got its place. And, you know, it's not like my club's better than your club, which tends to happen in human behaviour, doesn't it? And it doesn't do anybody any good at all, as we see and we observe the world as it is now and as it has been. Anyway, now like any religion, it's obviously about faith. But I thought I'd search out some examples, provide some kind of evidence for reincarnation. The first obvious one is from an organized religion, the Dalai Lama, which humorously... I'm sure many people might have heard it before, the Dying Lama, and that was a kind of touch of humour there for school kids growing up, I guess, who've heard of it. Anyway, the spiritual name, which is, stand by for this, Jetsin Yamphal Nguang Lobsang Yeshi Tenzin Gyatso, also known as Tenzin Gyatso Ni Lamo, Thundop. The 14th one, born 6th of July 1935, known to the Tibetan people as Gyalwa Pinpoche. Now, he's the top man, the Dalai Lama, the highest spiritual leader and head of Tibet. Now, he's considered to be a living Bodhisattva, which is a person, which is a path towards Buddhi awakening or Buddhahood. Now, here's the thing. The Tibetan government, what they do is they seek out a new one when the current one dies. They've currently got the 14th one. And the process can take an awful long time. For example, it took 4 years to find the 14th Dalai Lama, the current one. They look for signs where he will be reborn again, mainly limited to Tibet, but not exclusive, although the current one has stated it won't be anywhere under Chinese rule. The elder priests, they will endeavour to see things through visions, and then they look for signs, apparently. And when they think they've found the child, eventually, they go through a series of tests, a criteria, and the child is presented with certain objects, and they ask them to things about the Dalai Lama that they couldn't possibly know, in order to ascertain whether the child is the one that's been reborn. If the candidate is identified, the High Lamas report back to the top people and government. And if more than one is found, now this is amazing, if more than one is found, the successor is established, would you believe it, by the top people by drawing lots in a public ceremony, which is quite amazing, isn't it? When they go to all that trouble for this last one, 4 years, all over Tibet, finding the guy that they think, this is it, this is the one. But if they find two that's the same, and they've gone through all these tests, then they draw lots for it. The winner, or should I say successor, is taken together with the family to Lhasa or Dharamsala, which I guess is the headquarters, where the child will study the Buddhist scriptures in order to prepare them for spiritual leadership. Now, you can do your own research on this. There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of stories with reference to reincarnation in modern day, where people tell stories about their siblings or whatever have done these quite incredible things. So you can kind of do your own research on that. I've picked out one or two just for example. And this one I've picked out, and the problem with it is that they can't reveal their real names, because this chap is a famous author in America, in New York City, living with his wife, and for fear of ridicule and all the rest of it, and thought it would damage his reputation, he didn't want to give his name. Well, of course, when you don't give your name, it's unlikely for some people to think there's a credible thing going on. It's quite an incredible story, and I'll share it here. They lived in New York, and like a lot of these authors, you know, they go around the country and sometimes into Europe, perhaps, doing talks and seminars, all part of promoting their books and one thing and another. They had a son called Michael, and when he was very young, as a baby, he showed much interest in his dad's Rolex watch. And when he was starting to utter his first words, he kept touching his dad's watch and basically came out with the word, his very first word ever, saying, "Mine." Well, and he was always wanting to hold it. Well, one day as a toddler, when he was called by his name, he pointed at himself onto his chest and said, "Sonny, me Sonny." And from that point, he kept insisting that his name wasn't Michael, but it was Sonny. And eventually, his parents gave in and started to call him this kind of pet name, if you like, started to call him Sonny. Now, as time went by and his speaking became better as he grew older, he announces, "Me, Sonny Ray." Well, his mum at this point simply thought, as you do, that you know, he was joining words together and simply saying, you know, like Sonny Ray, that kind of thing, that sort of kids might do. But with the kid's insistence, the mum starts calling him My Little Sonray, after the kid's insistence that that's what his name was. As time went on, and he's getting a bit older, he said he had a wife by the name of Dawn, and they lived in Texas. Well, his parents rather strangely to this, but they did have a habit of listening to country and western on the radio, if that had anything to do with it. But anyway, when I mention country and western, I do have to be careful. Someone like me, as a blues player and a modern jazz player, often brings me out in spots. A touch of humour again there. No, but not only did he sing along to the music, a song that his parents, 100% he'd never heard before, started to sing along with the actual words, which really kind of shocked them and confused them, thinking, is something actually really going on here? Now, at this point, we could say, well, maybe he's heard the radio before without his parents being about. Is that a possibility? You could have probably sort of thought along those lines, maybe. Was he just making other bits up? At this point, I guess that's maybe what you'd be thinking. Well, one day his mum's looking at a book of dogs with him, and he picks out a spaniel dog. He says, "That's my dog Willie." So again, you know, the parents just thought he was just making things up, or just saying that, you know, dreaming, oh yeah, that's going to be my dog one day, a dog like that perhaps. So we fast forward, and the boy's now seven, Michael's seven, and his parents are away for a while. They're doing their the seminar around the country, find themselves in Texas. And they notice on the roster for the people attending the seminar, there's a lady there called Dawn Ray. And the guy, the author, thinks, So when they have a sort of coffee break or whatever, he takes an unusual step of approaching her, strikes up some conversation and says, do you mind me asking something? I'm sorry to ask this. Are you married? And the lady says, no, I'm a widow. I used to be. I lost my husband 8 years ago. What was your husband's first name, just out of interest? And she said, Sonny. So back at the hotel room, they explain all about their son and the things he's come out with. And they said, can I just ask you, do you ever had a dog? And she said, that's right, we did. We had a white spaniel. And she, in fact, my husband and the dog, were inseparable, almost inseparable. And what was the dog's name? And she says, the dog's name was Willie. So when we got to this stage, it was quite, wow, that was quite something. So she wanted to meet him. So they said, okay, we'll arrange something. And that was that. Well, later in the year, they flew down with Michael to Texas to go to Dawn's house to meet her. And as the door opened, the seven-year-old Michael runs and throws his arm round Dawn and recognises us and says, hello, Dawn. Then they asked him, do you recognise the house? And he said, no, I don't recognise the house. And then Dawn says, no, well, I've only lived here a couple of years. So once inside the house, they want to ask her a few more questions. And they said, did your husband have a watch by any chance? She said, yes, that's right. I've still got it, in fact. I've kept it. And she brought the watch down and she had it in its original box. Guess what? It was a Rolex watch. Michael then asked if she'd kept his guitar. She said, yes. And she brought out this guitar. Well, Michael picked it up. His fingers weren't big enough to kind of hit the fretboard properly. However, he goes straight into a sort of folk tune, sings it with the correct words, excuse me, and manages to finger certain chords and strum along with his other hand. Now, his parents were absolutely amazed at this because, to their knowledge, Michael didn't play the guitar. They'd never seen him with one ever. And he knew the words to a folk song that they'd never heard him do before. Now, here's the really strange thing. Dawn eventually moved to New York by the time Michael was 14 years old. And when he was 15 or 16, he asked his parents if he could go and live at Dawn's house. And the parents agreed. And apparently, he still lives there even today. Now, I'm not sure how long ago this was. But that is not only strange, I feel quite uncomfortable about saying that, as a lot of you would be, but apparently that was the story. But I'll go into this towards the end of the podcast, I think. But that makes me a little uneasy that actually happened there. The other thing that I hadn't fully checked out was the age of Dawn. I think probably mid to late 20s when Michael was 7. So you can work out the figures when he was 16. How old Dawn be. Now, it's an odd circumstance, that, isn't it? Living with her by the time he's 15, 16. That's odd. I find that very strange. But that aside, you know, the other part of it is very interesting, isn't it? The parents of Michael, who is a famous author. So, and this Dawn lady had come to one of his seminars. So, clearly, she reads all his books. And, you know, in the back of my mind, I'm kind of thinking, you know, obviously she's into his work, of what he writes about. And is there some sort of connection involved with all this? And has Michael unwittingly heard things along routes that might have joined things together? I'm just sort of dropping things in there for you to open your mind up and have a think about these things. Just my mind running over that. It wouldn't explain all the things, though, would it? Anyway, we'll move on to the next one. Just before I go into the third case, a man called Ian Stevenson, born 1918 to 2007, a Canadian-born American psychiatrist, did a vast study on reincarnation, including the person I'm about to talk about. So we'll come back to him in a short while. as he's collected so much on documentation on such a wide subject. So it's quite notable. Now, the case of Shanti Devi is perhaps one of the best cases to be recorded and was investigated by no other than a committee set up by Mahatma Gandhi, who appointed a committee in 1926 to look into it. Shanti, born in Delhi, India, and as a small girl claimed to remember details of a past life. Started around 4 years old, she told her parents she was from Mathura. That was her real home, where her husband lived, which was about 90 miles from her home in Delhi. At 6 years old, she actually tried to run off to try and get to Mathura. Now, at school, back home, she told people she'd given birth 10 days before her death. Interviewed by a teacher and headmaster, she used words from the Mathura dialect and said the name of her husband was Kedar Nath. Now, the head teacher, she was making these accents and syllables that she couldn't possibly do from where she was from, and at such a tender age. Anyway, the head teacher checked it out, and it turns out that a merchant existed who'd lost his wife, Luji Devi, 9 years earlier, 10 days after giving birth to a son. She knew many details that checked out, convincing the head teacher that she was telling the truth and this was correct. The government report concluded that the girl was this person reincarnated, and two more reports were done at the time. A report by the Balchand Nashata, published as a Hindi booklet, and in the book said, "What they found does not warrant us to conclude that Shanti Devi has former life recollections, or that the case proves reincarnation." So that was in that particular report. So there's conflicting reports here. I don't know why they came up with that or why they came up with the other, but there were counter claims to what she was saying. Another conflicting report on the same subject was by Indra Singh Sen, mother of a psychologist, author and educator, a devotee of the Sri Aurobindo, Indian philosophy, based on interviews from 1936, published to 52. So she was skeptical. Right, back to our psychiatrist, Ian Stevenson. He's done many, many years of research. Were on anecdotal case reports that had been dismissed by the scientific community. Now, these were all the cases that he studied. But, of course, these things in the scientific world become unreliable because Stevenson did not do any actual controlled experimental work. He was relying on case studies that had been filed and then been dismissed by the scientific communities. They were criticised for case reports full of errors and omissions. So, to be fair, Stevenson emphasised that the information he had was only suggesting reincarnation was possible. But there was no absolute proof. There was no proof at all. So, but if you search the internet, you'll find hundreds and hundreds of cases and strange happenings of people saying that were this, that and the other, and they can remember this and that. There's hundreds of cases. Then again, it all boils down to how much of it can actually be explained away, and is communication between people and children and people's conversations over dinner tables or whatever, and could all these things mismatch and come together with the imagination to produce something that seems like reincarnation. I mean, some of these stories, they do seem pretty credible. Others, not so much. Yeah, if memory serves me right, Netflix had a documentary. Well, I don't know whether it was a series or just one episode, I can't remember. But I remember this particular case about, they named the real parents in this one. The parents were real, you know, their real names. And their son, who was telling them he in a previous life he'd been sort of a pilot and a fighter pilot and all this sort of stuff. And when he was 3 or 4 years old, he lots of stuff that his parents went to the media, and it was clear by the end of the documentary, if not early on, that the The father had a huge interest in planes, and the son had been taken to air shows as early as 18 months, 2 years old. And a lot of the things that he was coming out with, it wasn't evidence, if you didn't know the whole thing, but everything amazingly came out. And he could, over time, he could have been fed these things. And what it looked like by the end of the film, the parents were out to make a few dollars, basically, or just about everything could be explained away. Although, of course, they completely deny it. Now here's the part of the podcast where I like to throw my own personal experience into the ring, as I like to do, a little bit of the personal touch of the Harpin with Harpo podcast. A few years ago, I'd watched the Netflix documentary, the one I've just mentioned, and I'd jotted a few things down about when I was a kid, 3-4 years old. I remember when I was 3, I told my mother that I'd been a pilot, you know, flown to America and all that, and I had a friend called Nicky. And my mother nearly fainted when I first told her all this stuff. My God, she couldn't believe it. And then after about the age of 4, I was making these things, and then after about the age of 4, I stopped. Now, I'm almost 100% that I was simply just using my imagination from television. Back in those days, there was a lot of American shows and films and war films, all sorts of stuff, from the United States, and a couple of times a day was a sort of an airport 10 or 12 miles away and a flight path going right across our house. However, I fast forward to the late 70s and find myself in a unit, a long-range reconnaissance unit, but I was actually working with the military, and I was with the, at this particular time, I was with the American military. But my best friend at that time was called Nick, and part of the unit was spending time in America flying, doing a lot of parachuting and a lot of what they call, in this country, in my country, we call habsailing, but it's called rappelling in the United States, where we rappel out of helicopters, out from the skis, down, and you slide down, and you do them in different formats and different ways. And I was doing all that sort of stuff. So you say, coincidence? Guy called Nick, doing a lot of flying. We weren't pilots, certainly not at that time, you know. Is that just a coincidence? Most likely, I think. I'd say 99.99% sure, it's not really anything. But I haven't seen that guy for over 30-some years. He's now a successful Hollywood producer, would you believe? We all go our separate ways, which is a point of interest. On another podcast, I may have mentioned my out-of-body experiences to do with myself as a saxophonist. That tended to be, when you're in the zone there, for me it just sort of sits on the front of your chest. It's not like you actually leaving your body, it's when you can actually play just about anything, if people experience things in different ways. But that's for another podcast. But I've also, when I was 10, 11 years old, the near-death experience where I did actually float up to a ceiling. Again, that's for another podcast. And that is something that really did happen to me. And I can talk about that on another podcast. You know, at this point, we all pause for breath and we ask ourselves the question, what is the scientific view for all these reincarnation theories and stories and what appears to be evidence? Now, over the years, I've had quite a few friends who were working as medical doctors. And so, you know, I approached them the same way as a friend, the same way that I'd talked to the scientific community. And they all kind of come up with the same thing, really. At least they're consistent in what they say. And basically, their viewpoint is that, you know, it's basically a fusing of electricity. And we're all made up of electricity. And these things sometimes get mished and mashed around. And it's just a phenomenon. It's just something that can happen, but it's not really meaning, there's no really proof or anything in it, even if it does seem a bit odd. That's how they kind of come to it. They don't sit on the fence. They recognise that these things kind of happen, but they just say it's just a fusing of kind of electrical things. And I remember many years ago, somebody had actually read my thoughts unwittingly. I didn't know for several hours. I was trying to work out what was going on. I won't go through the story. And I was seeing somebody on some health professional about something. Nothing wrong with me. My psychiatrist will tell you that. A touch of humour there. No, but I was seeing somebody about in that sort of world. and they I mentioned this this to some of them, and they came out with the same thing about the electricity. So on every corner, this is their basic one, and it's just that it's a pattern that spins around, and sometimes if you're sort of in a certain particular relaxed state, these things seem to appear. But there's that's kind of where they leave it, you know. At the end of it, they always say, "But that, you know, it doesn't prove reincarnation." That's what they tend to say. The only time I had a health professional take this kind of thing seriously was once, digressing slightly, but I'm sure interest to the listener, I had a near-death experience, and I explained, I don't really want to go through the ins and outs on this one, it's for another podcast, but on this near-death experience, I'd floated up to the ceiling and I could see exactly what was going on to me, and could see everything in the room, what was happening. And it was very vivid, and I was up in the corner of the room. When I'm talking to this particular health professional, they took that quite seriously. And then they told me about certain hospitals in intensive care where they had numbers above the lockers, up on the ceiling for people in intensive care when they were having a similar occurrence. And I said, what's the idea behind the numbers? And they said, well, the idea was that if anybody in ICU had experienced this, when they're recovering, they might have a conversation with them, and they'd ask them to tell them did they see any numbers. Quite often they'd say, yes, we did, and the number would correspond to when they're up in the corner of the room and they're looking down, and they could see the number on top of the locker, which would be impossible to see when they're all wired up in bed. So that was something they health professionals had shared with me at a quite senior level. So that was an interesting, and I'd kept that experience to myself for many years quiet, because, you know, I don't want people to think that you're some form of nutter, you know. But that's something else, that's for another podcast. But it's just of interest that's the only time that that's kind of been broken there, and they understand, or this particular health professional understood, that these kind of things happen. Now, whether I'd relayed that story I've just told you about myself to others, I recall, or whether it's the reincarnation, the same question is, you know, when you look at these people and say, well, what would actually convince you? What would convince you that, say, for example, reincarnation? So you're asking the scientific community now, and they all say the same thing. There has to be a consistent pattern as evidence. In other words, hundreds and hundreds of people at any one time, for example, would have to experience the same thing or a similar thing. 1 in 6 million people, or 10 in 500,000, or 3 in 900,000. I'm just making sort of ridiculous figures up now. But simply doesn't count for the scientific community. So in order, they have to see a pattern of behaviour in order to take a scientific view upon it. So however bizarre an isolated incident sounds or is or happening, it doesn't register with them, because they have to have a consistent pattern of evidence. So in a way, you know, they're not dismissing it, they recognizing that you're saying something, but they have to have some form of concrete or tangible sort of evidence. I mean, we're going back to, you want to go back and check the podcast I did on the whistleblowers. I can't remember what number pod it is, it's just a few back from this one, on the whistleblower and aliens and Area 51 and all of that. And again, it's the same thing, you know, if we're working on hearsay, or we're working on what somebody said and somebody said to somebody else, which we know these days in that's how they work in the law courts. It doesn't count as any form of evidence. And you have to have a consistent form of it. Lots of people have to have witnessed the same thing or similar, and there has to be a pattern of behaviour. And that is the logical approach. I guess it has to be like that, otherwise people could come out and claim just about anything, couldn't they? And if everybody took what everybody was saying, well, I suppose in some ways we get in this nowadays, aren't we, in 2024, with, you know, conspiracy theories and all the rest of it. Some of them may be true, and some of them might not be true. And we're getting this with social media now and all the rest of it. We're getting this almost cacophony of things. I mean, when you check back and look on the internet yourself, some of these reincarnation stories, some of them are quite incredible. But again, you know, in summary, there is no concrete evidence, as I've just explained why, from the scientific point of view. Now, as a musician, I might have mentioned earlier in the podcast that I used to come across a lot of the older guys, particularly people like the great Dizzy Gillespie, for example. They believed that they would come back better the harder they worked on their musical instruments, the better it was for next time round. And to a point, yeah, I sort of used to think a little bit along those lines, very vaguely. I'm not anything really, but I could see that it's a very good way because it continues. It makes you continue to work hard and play and push forward in anything that you love to do in the arts, and it makes sense. And if you thought, for example, that you were coming back, for example, here where we are at the moment, then you'd probably think, well, I better make sure I look after the planet because we're going to be coming back onto it and we're going to make it very difficult for ourselves if the planet's in worse shape than when I left it. Whereas if you think you're going off to some other dimension, i.e. heaven, glory, streets of glory, wherever you are going to go, you're going to be leaving the planet behind. So in one sense, perhaps it doesn't matter. I'm not saying that people wouldn't matter. Of course, everybody's concerned. But it's just an interesting idea, isn't it? That if you thought that, well, hey, you know, we are coming back here, when we're going to have to look after the place that we're in. And I've touched on that in other podcasts as well. I have to say, all the years I've been on the planet, that certainly in the arts, the people, certainly in the musicians that I spent my time with, a lot of them are very spiritual, although they're not organised in that way, but they feel that spirituality simply through doing their craft, you know, improvising or whatever sort of art they're into. But you know, in the arts generally, I think, but certainly I've noticed that along the improvising musicians. I don't know. I always like to turn it back to music, but it's like one of the greatest. Well, I think the greatest jazz guitar player, I think, was Wes Montgomery. Up to date, I think he's absolutely phenomenal. The guy didn't sight read, you know, and learned to play the guitar late, really, and he was absolutely phenomenal. Because he didn't sight read, you get these people that sort of, you know, to draw the analogy, if he could walk on water, they'd say, look at that, the guy can't swim. And I've come across people who, you know, feel that they have to go down logical routes all the time when they want to, say, become an improviser or whatever. Improvising in music, to me, whichever style you do, I think is, for me personally, is crucial. If you don't know how to improvise, then you've nothing to talk about. And unless you're the composer of the orchestra or whatever. But if you narrow it right down to the individual, it's all about individualistic freedom of expression. So, as we come to the end of this podcast and sort of summarise, really, that it's a little bit like the alien thing in some senses, that on one side you've got to have scientific proof, which we've talked about, and on the other hand, the faith doesn't require any authenticity, really, does it? It doesn't require anything because it's a faith. Doesn't need any evidence. And this is the dilemma that we have and all the upheavals that we have because of this kind of conflicting thing of proof and no proof and my club's better than your club kind of thing that, as I said at the start of the podcast, is part of the human condition, I think, or it seems to be, you know. But let's just hope that one day we can all try and live in peace and harmony. That's the thing, and hope's a good thing, isn't it, as we've said before. So let's hope that one day we can all get to that stage and push forward. All right, so that's it. I'm going to take you out with some more blues. Hope you've enjoyed the podcast. Don't forget, check out Harper the Healer on YouTube. And as always, I'll catch you on the rebound.